In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred, and it's time for your coolest conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage. Thanks for listening. Please remember to follow, subscribe, rate, and review. My guest today is a legendary Dion DiMucci, currently 82 years of age, and he's been active as a musician and a performer since his teens, and is one of the few remaining from rock and roll's early years. In 2020, we celebrated his artistry with a Dion Week in the Underground Garage that coincided with the release of his album, Blues with Friends. A year later, and he's back with its follow-up, Stomping Ground, due out November the 19th. And it also pairs him with his musician friends, including Eric Clapton, Bruce Springsteen, Billy Gibbons, and Kev Moe. And on our recent Coolest Song in the World, I Got My Eyes on You, Baby, he's teamed with Marsha Ball. Let's hear some of that track now, and then I'll be back with Dion on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Have some fun, won't feel all right.
Mighty Manfred with you here in Little Steven's Underground Garage, and joining me for a very special Coolest Conversations is singer-songwriter Dion DiMucci, whose career dates back to the first generation of rock and rollers. Now, last year saw him release a critically acclaimed album, Blues with Friends, and today we're speaking with him about the follow-up, Stomping Ground, due out November the 19th. It also features him performing blues tunes with a number of his musical friends. Dion, how are you?
I'm good, Manfred. It's a joy being with you. I'm unbelievably well. I'm enjoying life.
Oh, man. That sounds so good. You know, we spoke last July around the release of your previous album. We had a Dion Week going on here in the Underground Garage. And as I recall, you were weathering things pretty well there down in Florida. Have things continued to improve where you're at with regards to the pandemic?
Yeah, you know, and listen, you know, it's been a horror for a lot of people. I don't want to, you know, make it sound like tossing it off or making it light. But yeah, in spite of all the challenges and heartbreak, for me, in the downtime, so to speak, because we, you know, especially in the lockdown, it just, the pandemic kind of worked for me because I had nothing else to do with it. I mean, I had a lot of time, more time to pick up the guitar. And when I pick up the guitar, songs start coming down from, start raining down on me. I wrote 28 of the greatest songs I've ever written in the last couple of years. It's unbelievable.
Well, I like to hear that you say you wrote 28. Now, I know that Blues with Friends has like 14 tracks on it, and the new album has 14 tracks, and they're not, you do a cover on there, though, but let's get to talking about some of this stuff. So Joe Bonamassa helped you get the ball rolling for what became Blues with Friends. And as a track with him, you kick off the new album called Take It Back. Can you remind us how Joe was sort of integral to getting this whole project off the ground last time?
He did. You know, what happened is the same thing with the new album. I wasn't going for that, but, you know, he was the catalyst to kind of push it forward. I recorded like just like Blues with Friends or the new one, Stomping Ground, I went in, I recorded 14 songs. I had 14 tracks completed, but, you know, without the window trimming, so to speak. I know how to write a song. I know how to communicate a song. I know how to make it rock. I got the right bass, the right drum on it. You know, I love Rhodes piano and my guitar. And so the thing's, you know, a completed track. Well, you know, Joe Bonamassa hears the first one, Take It Back, and he says, Dion, I got to play on it. I said, hey, be my guest. And, you know, he did. Brought it into the studio. I actually filmed him doing it, and we have a little video of it. It's up on my site. But, you know, so he's, again, you know, it's Manfred, it's an amazing thing when you give an artist a completed track. In most cases, the track was completed, and to hear what they contribute, what they're hearing in your song, and what they want to contribute to it and infuse in it. So you give a track to a guy like Mark Knopfler from Dire Straits, or Billy Gibbons, you know, from ZZ Top, or Eric Clapton, or Peter Frampton, or G.E. Smith, any of these guys, you give them a track, and I don't tell them what to do. I just say, what do you think? I say, man, and the reason why I hand ask these guys if they'd like to play on the song is actually when I'm listening to the song in my truck, you know, I'm riding around, I think, you know, Mark Knopfler would sound great on this. I'm positive. Eric Clapton, if I could get him on this song, it would rock. And, you know, I handed it to them, and Eric was so grateful, man. He's a very grateful guy. He told me, he said, Dion, he said, you were part of my wake up with Big Bill Brunsey and John Lee Hooker and Robert Johnson. He said, you know, I'm a grateful guy. I've been able to record a CD, a tribute to Robert Johnson, and work with B.B. King and most of my heroes. And, you know, now you're asking me to play on this. He said, he said, I'm going to go in the studio. He said, I'm going to stand up like I'm playing before 20,000 people. I want to. And he did. And you could hear it. You could hear. He sounded like 19 years old. He was like,
we're thinking about the blues here for a moment. I mean, the blues, a wellspring that runs deep. Why drop your bucket a second time and 2 years into them? Why are you coming back to the blues?
Well, they were always there. I think it's in my DNA, you know, like I've been reading Unrequited Infatuations, Stevie Van Zandt's new memoir, you know. And he talks about knowing me for, you know, we go back to the early 70s. And, you know, we met in Las Vegas. And I was singing Come On In My Kitchen by Robert Johnson. And funny thing about it, he said, you know, because he was on Blues with Friends, and he knows that I really haven't reinvented myself. It's just a matter of maturing and developing and evolving, that I was doing Ruby Baby and Drip Drop and The Wanderer and, you know, back in the day, you know, and it's just an evolution of blues rock, which I've always been connected to. It's part of my DNA. I think even Run Around Sue was a cleverly disguised blues song.
Yeah. Well, last time you had liner notes from Bob Dylan, and this time you got Pete Townsend contributing liner notes. Now, why wasn't Pete playing on the album?
You know, I had Yeah, that's a good question, but I ran out of songs. It's a funny thing. I had completed the album, and I thought, you know, Bob Dylan was so gracious to listen to it and write his thoughts about it on the last one. I thought, you know, I love the way Pete writes, and he and Roger always loved the song I recorded in 1965 called Spoonful. And I recorded it with my Birdland Gibson and a tremolo pedal with I recorded it live with the Apollo Theater Orchestra. And they always loved it. And they said, how'd you do it? I said, we just did it live. They just followed me. That was it. So, you know, when I thought of having somebody say something about the album, but I love the way Pete Townsend writes, his use of words. Well, you know, I love the way Bono does it, and Springsteen, and so many guys that are so good with words, you know, that Dylan, of course. But Pete, I sent them the album. He listened to it. Send me back these liner notes. And Manfred, it's so funny. I called him. I said, oh, my God, you wrote about me in mythical terms. I'm gonna have to go out and buy a toga and perform these songs in a freaking toga. He said, you want me to rewrite them? I said, no, you only get one chance. You know, it's like the guys playing guitar. They are, you know, it's one pass. That's it. So, but he was fun. He was,
you know, you made mention of some of the artists that are contributing here, and let me go back through this list because there's so many great people on here. So there are a number that return from the first album, like Patti Scalfa and Bruce Springsteen. We already mentioned Joe Bonamassa. There's also Joe Menza, as you mentioned, Billy Gibbons, Sonny Landreth, and then the new album includes those folks along with Eric Clapton and Peter Frampton, Boz Scaggs, Keb Mo, Ricky Lee Jones, Mark Knopfler, G. Smith, Steve Kahn. But our coolest song in the world this week, that's the one that features Marsha Ball working with Jimmy Vivino. The track's called I've Got My Eyes on You, Baby. What can you tell us about this particular song?
Well, you know, it's a song I wrote, and I would open my show with it, you know, all the time. I just liked opening the show with it, you know, doing the rock and roll show. Listen, ever since I've been a kid, you know, I walked out in high school and I started singing and everybody started grooving. I haven't changed. So this song falls right into that bag, you know. So I thought, you know, I should record it, though. I should do a version of it here. So I did it. You know, Jimmy Vivino heads up the Conan O'Brien band. He's a great arranger, a great guitar player, and a real virtuoso. So I sent it to him and Marsha Ball. First, I sent it to Marsha Ball. I wanted to get her. But hey, there's nothing like Marsha Ball. She's a great boogie-woogie New Orleans queen of the keyboards. You know, she plays with no shoes on.
Well, I've seen pictures of her, but it never occurred to me that she didn't have her shoes on. I guess the first album I heard from her is like one of her rounder records, Hot Tamale Baby. And then the one after that, Gator Rhythms, I thought was pretty great. How do you even know Marsha? How did you cross paths with her? Do you recall?
Well, you know, I'm when you love something, you want to know more about it, and I love this music. So sometimes I'll take trips on the blues cruise and Marsha would be playing, or Samantha Fish, or, you know, somebody, you know, I like Chris Kane and people that I didn't know who Chris Kane was, man. If I played like him, I'd be king of the world. It's like crazy. Like the people that fly under the radar, you know? And so I've always enjoyed Marsha Ball up there, you know, doing her boogie woogie thing. She's just rocks it, you know? And And Jimmy, so it was fun doing that song with both these people. They both could do this with one hand tied behind their back. I mean, it's in their heart and soul.
So I've Got My Eyes on You, Baby. Is that an older song? That's not one that you wrote with Mike Aquilina, is it?
I wrote it by myself. I wrote it a while ago. It's never been on an album, or it's never been on a. Yeah, it's been a. I never put it out as a record. So I did do it in person quite a lot. It's not like opened my show with it a few years in a row.
Yeah, you mentioned that. But now a lot of these tracks on the album, did you write those with Mike Aquilina? Because I know you've collaborated with him for a while, haven't you?
I do. He kind of like puts a shining polish on it, for me sometimes. You know, he's a real wordsmith and a great friend, and we work well together, because I might have a song, a melody, a chorus, an idea, a character, and I want these words to come out of his mouth, and I have it half baked, and he really helps me with that. We throw it back and forth and come up with these great songs, I think.
Well, how long has that relationship gone on? How long have you guys known each other and been working with each other?
I've known Mike for about 15 years, maybe longer. Yeah, we met in Rome. It's a funny story. We were under the statue of Saint Jerome. And he said to me, "You know what they call Saint Jerome? They call them the Thunderer." I said, "Really? The Thunderer? Why?" He said, he didn't know how to talk to people. He would curse at people. "And he's a saint?" I said, "How could he be a saint if he like was snarly like that?" He said, "Well, it takes all kinds to make it to heaven." He said he translated the Bible twice, single-handedly, from Greek to Latin and then from Hebrew to Latin. Imagine how bright you got to be to know Hebrew and translate it into Latin and then in Greek and translate. I said, "This guy was off the charts bright." I said, "He gives ignorance knew me, because I was saying ignorance of scripture is ignorance of God." He was saying, "Well, this guy knows every word in the Bible." So we wrote a song called "The Thunderer," and the high school in the Bronx picked up on it, because the blues station was, I think you guys might have played it, and they picked up on it and called their football team the Thunderers. And it was on the front page of the New York Times. So that's how Mike and I started out.
Wow, very cool story. And the last album and this one to produce, you teamed up with Wayne Hood. And I know he's playing, I think on this particular track that we're talking about, our coolest song in the world, "I've Got My Eyes on You, Baby." He's on bass and drums. I think he also plays keyboards. Is it at Wayne's studio that you guys recorded Stomping Ground?
I do, man. He's a virtuoso, this guy. He's good, man. I love the way he plays keyboards. Yeah, he has a little studio about 15 minutes from my house, so it's a breeze. It's really enjoyable to work with him. He is really something.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
He's a fine.
And how did you find him?
I was at the gym, and this guy Steve Vittari was making some, he's a writer, he's from the Jersey Shore, he was doing some records there, he was recording some of the songs there. He says, "This guy's fun, you got to meet this guy." And I went, yeah. But then I met him, and I haven't looked back. I just we work so well together, man. I found my, like the dream team,
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you got two home runs with these guys so far. Another track I'd like to mention is your cut with Billy Gibbons on Stomping Ground. The song's called "My Stomping Ground," which I guess lent its title to the album. You work with Billy on "Blues with Friends." Tell me some about working with Billy Gibbons.
Billy Gibbons is the most unique guy, most distinctive character I've ever met.
Well, that's saying something, isn't it? Most distinctive character you've ever met? I mean...
Well, you want to know, my idea of art, great art, is something very familiar. Like you say, there's a tree. I know that's a tree. But it's very distinctive. There's something different about it. You've never seen it that way. You've never heard it that way. The colors, the form, you know, whatever. So Billy is one of those kind of people. The way he dresses, he communicates, the way he talks, the way he moves, the way he plays, the way he writes, the way he thinks, everything about this guy, the way he writes an email. It's unfreaking believable. It's like, it's always has substance and it's entertaining. And it's different. It's distinctive, you know? So that's why I say that. And, certainly the way he plays guitar, like you could hear two notes and you know it's Billy Gibbons. Well, you know, Stomping Ground needed that kind of gravitas. So off it went to Billy Gibbons. And, you know, he's just a joy to work with, man. I don't know. You know, he's so steeped in the music I love. And it's a lot of fun to work with people who get you and get it, you know, and you could just roll with it, you know. And so he just, on both these songs. And, you know, he's given me some great compliments. Like one time he told me, he said, "I don't know what it is with you, Dion. Every syllable you sing is in the right place."
What was it, every syllable?
Every syllable, I said.
Well, that's good to know. It's good to know that you keep it in the pocket with whatever you're saying.
Yeah. Well, that's me. I'm a rhythm singer. It's got to be right there, you know.
Absolutely. Well, you know, there's only one cover on the album, a version of Red House, Jimi Hendrix song, Red House. And you do that with Keb Moe. So what is it about that particular tune that resonated so much with you, you decided to do a version of it?
Manfred. Red House by Jimi Hendrix is my favorite Jimi Hendrix song. And if you are going to study the blues, like the slow blues and attitude and how to play it, how to sing it, how to embody it, you got to study that record. There's nothing like it. Nothing. It's perfect. It's a perfect record. So I love it. And I thought, well, I know people who try to cover it or, you know, try to do it something like it. No cigar. I'm sorry. I don't care who you are, buddy. I don't care who you are, you know, John Mayer. You're not going to, you know, Jimi Hendrix. I'm sorry. No cigar. Close, you know, good, but no cigar. So I thought, I got to do this song. I love it. I did a Dion version of it. I did it. I sang it to Kev Moe. He says, "Yeah, I get it. It's going to the same place as Jimmy's, you got it." He said, "No, I'm aboard. I like it." So I did a Dion version of it. You know, it's totally different, but it expresses the heart of the lyric and the song.
And so playing the slide on that is who? Is that Keb Moe?
Yeah.
If I understand correctly, there is a musical based on your life called The Wanderer. I was reading this off a press release. I hadn't heard about this, and it said that it's going to stage its world pre-Broadway premiere at the Paper Mill Playhouse, Millburn, New Jersey, in March of next year. How involved are you with this production?
Well, I am involved with it because I thought, you know, a friend of mine wrote it. Charles Messina, I walk the streets with him. I have lunch with him all the time, you know, and he's a playwright. And I've never seen him write anything down on paper or type anything into his computer, but he comes up with this story after our conversations. And, you know, you give me something of substance, you can entertain me all day long. And that's what he did. He wrote, you know, a play that's full of like rock and roll street history and action and betrayal and overcoming and romance. And the way he places a lot of the songs, I mean, most of the songs are my songs. So but where they're placed, it's not chronologically. It's like in the story, it moves the story, you know, forward. So, I mean, I think the play starts off with King of the New York Streets. So, and you have a lot of laughs in it. And I tell you, Manfred, if I knew that Broadway would be so much fun, I would have probably been involved with it a while ago. But to be in a room with like 35 great, talented young people who want to give you their best, it's really like life-giving. It's uplifting, man. It's a lot of fun, and they listen to you. They grab onto a lot of the stuff you're trying to convey to them. You know, I'm never like I got to push, pull, or prod. You know, but you know, you don't want any. You know, if somebody's doing "I Wonder Why," you want to get them out in the hallway and say, "Hey, check this out. Watch my mouth." You know what I mean? You got to get, so you want to keep it authentic and you want to keep it genuine. You don't want it to be, become salmonized, you know?
Well, right. In fact, I was wondering, for the purpose of the story, specific events, it wouldn't be unusual for them to be stylized to some degree, you know, it's the telling of your story, but it's in the context of a play. But did when Charles was writing this, was there any particular event where you thought, no, actually, this is too stylized. This, you can't express it. We can't do it this way because that's not what really happened. Or is it pretty much, you know, in the ballpark of when the specific events, especially important, tipping points or specific, the most important, the highlights, the things that really kind of further the story, are those really rooted into your actual events, the way they unfold on the stage?
Pretty much, you know, you try to keep it authentic, you know, and to convey some of those feelings. Hey, and little Steven, you know, Stevie Van Zandt watched this thing more times than once, you know, he was in the room with me. So between the both of us, nothing gets past us.
That's so true. He's very good about that.
Yeah. He's, oh no, you know, yeah. So, I mean, we're not going to let anything go by that's, you know what I mean? That grab onto, that's not some kind of, because hey, you know, like, you look at West Side Story, those people were trying to imitate who we really were, you know? So we try to keep it real, you know, we want to entertain people. So there's kind of a balance. You kind of do this balance thing and this compromise thing, but it's got to land in a place of being genuine and real and truthful, and it's got to land right.
When I spoke about this premiere, it's, as I read it, is pre-Broadway premiere. So the plan for it is to go on to The Great White Way. Is that right? That's the ultimate plan.
Yeah, a place like Paper Mill Playhouse, it's a very prestigious regional theater, and it's the same dimensions as Broadway. So when you build this beautiful set, you know, for $1 million, you can move it from there to a theater on Broadway. It's the same dimension. So they hold the play will be out at the Paper Mill Playhouse for about 6 weeks. That's where they'll hone it and you know, get all the kinks out of it and then move it to Broadway.
Wow. That's, well, looking forward to that. You know, last time we spoke, you had quoted St. Augustine, and I think the quote was, when you're singing, you're really praying twice. And I didn't have a chance to follow up with that. And I wanted to, if you can, you could explain that a little bit further. When you're singing, you're really praying twice.
He said something like that, right? When you're singing, you're praying twice. It's like, you know, listen, Manfred, when you're inside a song, it's like you know exactly who you are. You're connected. You're connected to the gift. It's like, what makes you think? What, you know, it's a higher reality. It's like, you know, people ask me about these songs and these albums I'm doing. And I say, you know, I couldn't plan it if I tried. A lot of it is just being under the wellspring of creativity, of being under the spout where the glory comes out. Like God, I think God gave us all a gift of creativity, and some people just don't tap into it. Like people ask me now, how could you still be doing this? Why are you doing? And I say, I got a gift. What am I going to do? Sit in the chair and let it rust? You know, you want to use it. I want the guys that have passed on and have prayed, like Buddy Holly and Sam Cooke and Tom Petty, all these guys. I want to make them proud, you know, that I'm using it, not just sitting around. I want a thumbs up from the angels up there.
Well, speaking of the angels, last album, you had Patti Scalfa and Bruce Springsteen helping you out on track, on the track called Hymn to Him. On the new album, they contribute to Angel in the Alleyways, which is my favorite song on the album. I have to admit that's my favorite. You can hear Patti on the backing vocals. I think Bruce Springsteen, is he playing harmonica?
Playing harmonica and that tremolo guitar you hear.
Okay.
And I got to tell you, Manfred, that this is the only song that I sent out that was not completed. I sent this song to Patti with my vocal and guitar. And she asked me, she said, Dion, do you have anything else on it that you're holding back, like a bass and drum? I said, nope. I said, that's it. I said, I wanted you to hear it just very plain so you could hear where I'm breathing and you hear the words. And if you wanted to do some harmony, if you wanted to echo some lines, if you wanted to punctuate some lines, you know exactly what I'm doing. So, you know, I'm sending it out in the most simple form I can send you. So what happens is, and I kid you not, you'll know what I'm talking about. I don't know if your audience will know, but she and Bruce sent me back 64 tracks.
What? 64? Wow.
My career is in 64 tracks. So I said to Bruce, what, you know, he said, you want us to mix it? I said, no, I'll mix it. He said, well, I got to tell you this. He said, everything you hear on Angel in the Alleyways is Patti Scalfa's production. She loved the song. It really resonated with her, and she produced it. So what are you hearing on it? If you hear Bruce playing harmonica or tremolo or her stacking her vocals, let me tell you this. There's five verses in this song, and every verse is different. She produced every verse. That's how close, you know, she didn't phone it in. Let me put it that way, right?
All right, we're going to take a listen to it in a moment. So the song itself, does it come out of your own spiritual journey?
It does, because, you know, there's no way to explain some of these things. Manfred, in the 60s, I was really in trouble, taking a lot of drugs and drinking, and I was really lost in a way, and I said a little prayer and something touched me. I don't know if, you know, I got touched in a very, I was walking across the street, you know, in New York from one side of the street to the other. And by the time I reached the other side of the street, I was changed. I haven't had a drug or a drink in 54 years. So, it was the obsession or the compulsion, whatever you want to call it, was taken right out of me. So I started becoming aware that, in a sense, I felt like I was known, and God didn't put me here just for folly to see me walk into walls. That He knows me, and He sees what, you know, and to allow to stay open and allow, you know, all this positivity into my life, and not because, you know, like it's what you're open to. You could concentrate on the solution or the problem, and you concentrate on the problem, it gets bigger. You know what I'm saying? So I just felt like there was so many times in my life. Look, at my age now, man, sometimes I wake up in the morning, I go, God, how did you get me here healthy and vital and still relevant and creative and full of mystery and wonder and awe? And you continue to bless my socks off. Thank you. I just feel grateful when I wake up in the morning. I just, so yeah, I had, and on top of it, I guess it comes, somewhat from a mild Catholic upbringing. I talked to Steve and Bruce about this. I know Bruce had a Catholic church right behind his house. He saw all the funerals, the weddings, the confirmations, the, you know, the baptisms. So, yeah, you know, it's somewhere in our DNA, you know, that no matter what we profess sometimes, it's just there.
I've kind of got this image. Well, first I'll ask you, related to Angel in the Alleyways, do you feel like you've had sort of a guardian angel, or was this sort of this change that took about, that was just kind of you, a more direct sort of channel, direct channel to God, as opposed to having an angel, you know, sort of working or spirit guide looking out for you? Do you think you have a guardian angel?
You know, I must. And if I do have one, probably he's pulling his hair out and go, oh my God, is he doing that again? You know, but
so how about this? I was wondering about this. So we all pass on. So there you are at the pearly gates, and St. Peter's up there, and he says, hey, you know, we've always been very impressed with your work, Dion. And we were wondering if you would consider being somebody else's guardian angel, you know, would that be a task that you would take on?
I think I'd take it on gladly, because I'd probably want to watch over my family or whoever. I think it's, because that's what life is about. It's about giving, you know. It's, I got to tell you, my friend Stevie Van Zandt is one of the biggest, don't let him fool you. I mean, he looks intimidating, but he's one of the biggest givers on the face of the planet, you know, and one of the brightest guys I know. So in a way, he's kind of an angel in my life. He's kind of tweaked my direction and at many times in my life. He's one of those guys who's not too involved in himself. He's kind of like, you could put him in a think tank. He observes other people. He said, Dion, I think you should go this way, but never pushy, you know, in a beautiful way. So, you know, life is kind of like that. I would love to, even though I'm really, listen, I got involved in a spiritual 12-step program 54 years ago, and you know, they say, you know, junkies and alcoholics are selfish, self-centered, self-seeking, inconsiderate, fearful, and dishonest. I went, yep, that's me. You got me. Okay. So I got to work hard at it, you know, but I'm on board. I'll try to be a giver. I got to work hard on it. Some people are naturals, and Stevie is a natural.
Dion, thank you so much for speaking with me again on our Coolest Conversations.
Manfred, I appreciate the time. Thank you. You have a great day. God
you
bless
as, you as well, sir. Now it's time to take a listen to Angel in the Alleyways. It's Dion off the new album Stomping Ground, due out November the 19th. And you're hearing it here in Little Stevens Underground Garage.
How to stay beneath the light? Do you sense it as you go? Maybe you are not alone. An angel walks, an angel prays. Hey, by your side at night unseen.
With some help from Bruce Springsteen and Patti Scalfa, that's Dion here in Little Stevens Underground Garage with some of his track Angel in the Alleyways. The song is part of the new album Stomping Ground, due out November the 19th. This is the Mighty Manfred, and many thanks again to Dion for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. And joining me next time will be Colin Blunstone, lead singer of The Zombies. The 60s band has since reformed, but back when they initially dissolved, Colin pursued a solo career, and his debut album, 1 Year, produced by his former bandmates Rod Argent and Chris White, is enjoying a 50th anniversary reissue on Sundazed Records. We'll talk about the album, as well as The Zombies, then and now, on your next Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Stevens Underground Garage.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.